Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You have probably heard by now that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth face elevated risks for depression, suicide, bullying, and violence. You may not realize they are also at significant risk for homelessness. Nationwide, 43% of young people without permanent housing identify as LGBT. Some have been kicked out of their parents' homes, some have run away, others have been abused by either biological or foster families. They can't go home, but most are far from ready to take good care of themselves. In 2004, Ryan Berg went to work at a group care home for LGBT adolescents in New York City. He was committed to providing a safe and supportive environment, but he soon realized the challenges of exploring their identities and building productive lives without families to nurture them were greater than he ever imagined. He had been wholly unprepared, as he writes, for the scope and scale of challenges in trying to build those lives. Ryan Berg is Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow, and he writes about his experiences as a residential counselor and caseworker in his new memoir, No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. Ryan, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book is full of truly devastating stories at a time when a lot of Americans feel like maybe we've turned a corner in providing equal rights and legal protections for LGBT folks. You argue that as a society, we remain negligent. That's your word in caring for the needs of LGBT teenagers.
Right. I think, you know, we've seen with the LGBT movement, there's been incredible strides forward in recent years, marriage equality being a huge, huge one. But we have neglected our youth. We have turned our back to the issues that need to be addressed with them and for them, and in order to provide support for so they can move forward in their lives.
Why do they get neglected? Is it because we're uncomfortable with the idea that teenagers have any kind of sexuality at all?
That's a good question. You know, I think maybe that's part of it. I worked within the foster care system, and part of the neglect is married to abuse as well around the issue. Many foster parents come into, and this is not speaking about all foster parents, there are very good foster parents out there, but there are foster parents that are out there for a check, and they provide negligent care for young people. Oftentimes, a young person who is struggling with identity issues around sexuality or gender can be a huge challenge for folks who don't see that aligning with their own values or ethics. Oftentimes, youth that come into foster care and their gender identity or sexual orientation is discovered, the foster parent says, "I'm not taking this youth," and they are rejected again and re-traumatized again, brought back to the agency, and the agency attempts another placement and another placement. So there's just this continual cycle of rejection that many youth contend with. Mm. End up in group homes, such as the one that I worked in, which often house, which the system calls hard-to-place youth. And those youth then, by turn, are given supports around independent living, but very rarely are connected to a community or a supportive, caring adult that could help them move forward in their lives.
What were your responsibilities when you worked at the group home, and what kind of training did you get ahead of starting there?
So I started in 2004 as a residential counselor, which basically is a direct care worker living in the home with the youth. I lived in a 6-bed home with the youth Wednesday through Friday. I'd arrive Wednesday morning, and I wouldn't leave until Friday p.m. And the training, the agency gave training around resiliency, a little bit around trauma. This is kind of before the movement towards trauma-informed care, which is happening now. There was more talk about behavioral management with youth, how to address oppositional behavior instead of really addressing the core behind the behavior, the mm-hmm. history behind the behavior, and what trauma they may have experienced that might be influencing that behavior. And then when I was a case manager or a caseworker for a sister program, you know, the training around that is more about paperwork and the bureaucratic kind of ends of things, the kind of dotting your I's and crossing your T's and making sure all the appropriate paperwork is in, everything's accounted for. Every face-to-face contact has to be addressed and noted, and every contact with a family member has to be noted. So there's a real focus on documentation, mm-hmm. and not so much around what services and supports we can provide to a young person to help them move forward in life.
How much time were you able to spend just sort of being there for them in a way that, if not a parent would function, maybe a trusted teacher or neighbor or aunt or uncle?
You know, the challenge was I was kind of tethered to my desk due to the paperwork when I was a case manager. But I definitely, youth have to be encountering their case managers at least once a week face to face. And that can be as simple as just going, you know, what many case managers do is they would just go to the group home on a day and try to kind of have contact with each youth at some particular time. I really tried to build relationships with the young people that I worked with. It was challenging because of time. So oftentimes my 8-hour workday, you know, would extend out quite a bit in order to, you know, meet the needs of the youth. If it was to go on a job interview with them or take them in to get their essential documents, or perhaps it was, as I mentioned in the book, there was a open house for homeless youth or fostered youth to be possibly be adopted. So I'd go on to, you know, into these kind of longer hours with youth. And in those hours, it was really about building relationships with young people. And I feel like that's really the essential core of what's missing for a lot of young folks. I think within foster care in particular, there are two goals that case managers have. The first is reconnection with family, reunification, they call it. And the second is independent living. And there isn't really who lives independently without community and without support. So I think there's kind of a setting youth up for failure in that way. So my job, as I saw it, really was about building relationship, becoming that caring and consistent adult for the young people that I worked with in the way that I could. And, you know, any young person, regardless of their housing situation, they go out into the world and, you know, things don't necessarily work out the way they want them to. And they need someone to kind of turn to in those moments. And I tried to be that. And even after I left the job, you know, I still have relationships with the young people that I worked with.
You write about a young trans woman named Bella. When we meet her, she is very close to aging out of the system. What's supposed to happen in the months leading up to that moment? How are you trying to prepare these young people for when there are no more state-provided supports?
Right. So young people age out in New York of foster care at the age of 21. Most states, it's 18. There is extended foster care in some states that provide these supports in kind of an aftercare kind of mode. So, you know, it's really working with that particular young person where they're at. So the job of the case manager really is to determine throughout the duration of their stay within foster care, has the goal plan been reunification with family? If there's no family, then it's independent living. Well, how do we work on independent living skills with a young person? Typically, those goals would be around education, job, and securing some kind of housing. The specific challenges of working with Bella, she had a pretty severe addiction to crack cocaine. She was transgender and found it difficult to find any kind of secure employment due to her transgender identity. And because of that, she found her way into the sex trade, and she it was about survival for her. She couldn't find work in any other way, and she found it within the sex trade community. And so the challenges that I was up against was trying to find a way to minimize harm within her addiction, so we could focus on some more long-term sustainable goals. Education was kind of out the window at this point. It was more about, I need to find you a place to live. We need to do this together. And because of her situation and the dire circumstances around her situation, she closed down. And she, you know, that makes sense to me. So she really just turned away from what we were trying to do with her. All the kind of strides we were making initially kind of just kind of came to a screeching halt. And so it ends up that she, you know, became homeless.
One of the reasons that she wanted money was that she wanted access to feminizing hormones. She ended up getting these on the street. I guess that was part of the reason that she was turning tricks. It has to be hard at the point at which she is still at least nominally in your care to see her self-destructing and have limited authority to really do that much about it.
Right. She's a young adult at this point. And, you know, there is, it's limited authority, but just limited power. I mean, really it's around how strong that relationship is to kind of help steer behavior. Yeah, she was, like many youth that I worked with that were transgender, couldn't go through the process of meeting a therapist on a regular basis in order to be prescribed the feminizing hormones that they would need, and oftentimes had a hard time just staying on track as far as when they were supposed to be taking the hormones. So oftentimes youth would go to the black market and they would find money in order to get these hormones through sex work. You know, I think a really interesting kind of counter to this is what's happening right now with this kind of new acknowledgement and acceptance and understanding of trans women around Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox, and the kind of privilege that they have and having the resources available to them to kind of access these hormones. And many young trans people, primarily trans people of color, don't have access to that. And it's a challenge. And they, you know, have to use whatever minimal resources they do have in order to get what they feel they need.
Other teenagers you worked with had HIV infections. It wasn't always possible to convince them of the importance of staying on the meds that would keep them from developing AIDS.
Yeah, that was a definite challenge. We could, with med use in the house, typically if they're living in a group home, there's med distribution, right? So they don't keep their medication on themselves. It's kept in a locked, safe space within the home. And then there's a conversation around when to take it. Most youth would take it when it was made available to them. The problem is once they leave care, then self-administering their medication became a huge challenge. For many of them, even access to having their medication, you know, if they're experiencing trauma and they've never worked through that trauma, and they're dealing with a lot of mental health issues, it's rough to normalize that behavior for themselves.
Ryan Berg is my guest. He's a Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow and a one-time caseworker in a New York City group home for homeless LGBT teenagers. His new book is called No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a message on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ryan Berg. He worked as a caseworker in a New York City group home for homeless LGBT teenagers. Now he's a Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow and author of a new book called No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Ryan, it would seem that young people with similar reasons for being rejected or abused at home might find some common ground living together. There was, though, a great deal of conflict among these kids. What did they fight about? How did you handle it?
Yeah, conflict was common, but I think that's common with any group of youth. I mean, I think, you know, they're adolescents. There's drama involved. I was just at a reading last night, at a reading for the book, and a former youth that I worked with read with me, you know, and she talked about the name calling and, you know, the kind of transphobia and homophobia that, and even the racist stuff that would come out between youth. And then it was more about, like, you know, those insults came out of the fact that you stole my shampoo, or I think you stole my shampoo, but oh, you didn't steal it? Okay, never mind. Sorry. It was a lot of it was just relational, and there were some bigger issues on occasion, but a lot of it also was just kind of like this embedded trauma that would flare up. I think one of the bigger fights that I talk about in the book revolve around a friendship between two people, and Bella, who you had mentioned previously, ends up in the hospital because of a related issue with her addiction. And I was talking to a young resident about it, and then another person comes in and kind of makes some kind of flip comment about Bella. And then there's just this altercation, this kind of explosive altercation that takes place around that. And it's about protecting your own, protecting your friends. It's what little things you have in life you hold dear when you're in these kinds of situations. Those are the larger issues.
You also capture the fact that, I mean, you know, living with teenagers can be challenging. They could be sort of rude and lazy about chores in the same way that teenagers maybe all over America are. What did you do on days when they were just hard to like, even though you knew that it was your job to provide good, compassionate care for them?
Remind myself of my privilege and of why they were there. Yeah, there were moments where I was just like, would you just be quiet? You know, would you stop yammering about this? Or would you, you know, just participate in this? And my boss at the time was fantastic on kind of returning perspective around those issues, reminding ourselves that of the trauma, the neglect, the abuse, the systemic oppression that they've all experienced on such great scale. And there were reasons that the behavior was the way it was, and I needed to be mindful of that and intentional in the way I would respond.
Your boss was a tough cookie in the best possible sense of the word. Can you tell us a little bit about the tone that she set in the house?
Yeah, so early on, I think you're referring to the senior residential counselor at the beginning of the book.
Yes.
She is a tough cookie. She's old school. She was a older black woman, and she knew how to run the house the way she wanted to run it, which was kind of by strict rule. And, there's no playing around, but the youth responded to her in a really kind of loving, warm way. They called her mama. And there was no mincing words with her. I came from Iowa and was in New York for about 3 years by the time I took this position. And this was just a complete culture shock and a slap to the face. And so a lot of my initial engagements with the youth were kind of timid, and I wanted to really be liked by the youth. And she set me straight that this wasn't about me, that this wasn't about me being liked. This wasn't about being friends with these young people, that this was about being a caring, consistent adult. And sometimes we had to be frank and upfront with them to steer them in the correct direction.
What drew you to this work in the first place?
Yeah, that's complicated. I always thought of myself as someone who kind of had their finger on the pulse of issues that were kind of in the media, and But I didn't have any experience working with youth. I didn't have any experience in the foster care system. I was working in theater in New York at the time and just felt it was too insular. And I wanted to have a, I wanted to be a part of something greater and invoke some kind of change. I didn't know what that looked like. And I found this job listing, applied for it, and went through a series of interviews with folks and wasn't even sure that it was what I wanted to do. I made the commitment to work there for a year. And within the first month, I was unsure if I could do it. It was incredibly difficult. It was way more challenging than I'd ever expected. I had no point of reference for the kind of systemic cultural difficulties. The challenges around economic and racial justice, all new to me. And it really put in perspective my own privilege. And then to see the young people and the challenges that were they were up against in the system. The system that's made that's created to provide supports for them, but in many ways hindered any availability towards moving towards success. And that became enraging to me. Once you start to build relationships with these young people and you get to see how brilliant they are and just nuanced and complex, and you want them to succeed, but yet they're constantly being pushed up against these walls. And it seems like a litany of failures and traumas and challenges. And I couldn't see myself leaving after that. I was in it.
It was striking to me that like one of the happiest endings for one of the young people that you worked with is a young woman who gives birth at a very young age, is still living in like a transitional housing situation. That's like the gold standard among the many children, young people that you worked with. And it's got to be hard to see so many of them maybe deserving a chance at success and based on a combination of circumstantial factors and abuse and their own bad choices, you yep. pretty much know it's not going to happen ever.
Right. Well, it does happen. It takes time. It takes a lot of time and it takes some growth. And, we know that, young people, the brain isn't fully developed until the age of 25. And when you're experiencing trauma, oftentimes, a young person who's 19 years old is emotionally responding as a 15-year-old. So there is this kind of trajectory in this, there's a patience that's needed. The young person that you're referring to is now living on the West Coast and is still working hard on having some stability in her life, but has a relationship, has a family, has a job. So, I think a large part of it is about managing expectations around what success looks like for folks. And I think in this country, we have the kind of American myth of, if you just work hard enough and pull yourself up by your bootstraps, it'll work out for you. And the reality is that, someone who's put forth the same effort that I'm putting forth may not have the same results. And, I think that's due to the kind of systemic oppression that a lot of the young people are faced with.
Do you think that family reunification is a reasonable goal, or that at least it should be a primary goal for young people in situations like this who are with you mostly because they have been abused or neglected?
Sure. That's complex. I think family reconnection, maybe more so than family reunification, meaning that maybe they won't ever be able to live with family again, but if they can start to build that kind of tenuous relationship into something a little stronger where there's a little more respect and understanding on both sides, I think there is room for then building that network of community that's so essential for successful movement forward in a young person's life. I think part of what the system needs to really do is work on prevention. And I think getting in early before a young person is ejected from their home or run away from their home, if families have some education around these issues of sexual identity and gender identity, there may be a chance that the young person won't have to leave to begin with. A lot of these families are loving. A lot of these families do care a great deal about the young people in their lives, their children. They just need some supports around understanding and some education around what it actually means that their young person in their family is transgender, and how they can provide those some supports and with the networks that are out there available to them.
What do you do for a family that may have great love for a young person, but feel that they are doing that teenager a disservice by accepting them as gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, that they feel like they, in order to do the right thing for them morally, they have to disapprove and cut them off?
You know, I guess it comes down to how willing that family member is to hearing other points of view, how compassionate they are and how in their response. And do they see severing a tie and letting a young person end up homeless as more severe than the alternative? It's kind of weighing out those pros and cons. And there are a lot of families that, you know, the truth is that you touched on the statistic early on. It's family rejection is a huge part of LGBT youth homelessness. That's non-debatable, but, there is this other, I think there's room for conversation and talk. There is a great program in San Francisco, that works with family reunification, and it's called the Family Acceptance Project. And their main focus, really, I believe, is to work on building those tenuous relationships and educating family members. And, you know, maybe there isn't room for that young person to move back in, but at least that family could potentially be a support again, and there could be room for relationship. And that's a starting point.
It's not necessarily only families or people in the foster care system that really shove these kids aside. Can you tell us about Christina? The girl you call Christina.
Sure. Christina is a young trans woman, 16 years of age, Latina from the Bronx. Christina has such self-determination. She's brilliant. She knows exactly what she wants out of life, but yet she's drawn into the challenges that many youth experience on the street. She lost her parents early in age to gang violence and AIDS, and was left to live with her aunt, who took her in initially as Christina was identifying as male at the time. And as she started to kind of struggle with her own identity and come to terms with her own identity, the family was unwilling to work with that young person. And Christina became homeless as a result and then ended up in our program. And then subsequently found her way to the piers in New York, where many youth end up strolling for money, meaning that they were engaging in sex work. And there's an allure to that. I think, you know, there's community on the piers. Historically, the piers are a place for LGBT youth of color to congregate, to engage, to build, you know, family, created family. Their own families reject them. They create their own families, and that's where many of them were at. Unfortunately, it can be a perilous and dangerous place for many youth, and Christina was unfortunately one of those youth who didn't survive that world. She ended up disappearing with a John and never found again. And, you know, she was so self-determined. She had so many things going for her, but the pull and this massive disconnection, like she just was so disconnected from anyone who provided that kind of caring, consistent component that I think so many young people are craving even though they might push you away, they're craving, and she didn't have that in her life, and you know, she was floundering, and she presented very well. So with a lot of us, when we were all overextended within the work we were doing, her issues at the time didn't seem like crisis to us, right? So she seemed to be maintaining. We'd check in. Things would be going well for the most part, or at least that's what she would at least report to us. And to come to find that, you know, really she was one of the ones that really needed us the most. And unfortunately, it came to a dire conclusion.
After she disappeared, you were frustrated because it seemed like the police weren't even that interested in looking. And you, I can hear it in your voice, had regrets. Do you think her story was worse, or she just had the very bad luck of being victimized and presumably killed by someone who pulled her off the street?
I think it's complex, and I think it's probably a mixture of both. I think to your point around the police acting indifferent towards the situation, I mean, the cops typically, we were talking about this last night at the reading, they don't want to engage in that search. And that speaks to value, how as a culture and a society we value certain people over others. Yes, she engaged in sex work. That's not a question. Does that mean her life is less important or valued? And we have to look at why she had to engage in sex work. You know, there's a history there, a history of lack of support. It's a complex issue, and I think it's a bit of both.
My guest is Ryan Berg, Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow and author of a new book called No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ryan Berg, a one-time caseworker in a New York City group home for homeless LGBT teenagers. He is a Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow and author of a new book called No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. Ryan, this was really stressful work for you personally. You were making the use of the services of a counselor who was provided a psychologist to sort of talk to folks doing this work. But when you weren't on the job, you would go home. You were drinking a lot. When did you start to realize that you couldn't continue in that situation?
It was about a month after Christina went missing that I really had to do some internal work and investigate what I was capable of doing and if I was providing the services and the care and the support that these young people needed. Was I, you know, capable of taking that on beyond my own issues? And, you know, that was a struggle. I didn't want to say goodbye, but I felt myself depleting and needing to take care of myself. So I had to step away. And, you know, and a lot of the challenges around that were around the frustration with systems. I mean, doing the direct care itself is challenging, exhausting, and emotionally taxing. But the frustration around the limitations that the systems put on the workers, I think, compounded that. It's called compassion fatigue within the social work world. And, you know, I didn't want to get to a place where I was just going through the motions and it was going to become rote. I wanted to maintain the engagement, the level of engagement that I started with the youth. And I wasn't capable of doing that within this framework. And so after a reprieve, I'm doing that work again. But on the other side, I'm doing work with homeless youth outside the system.
What is wrong with the system? And I ask this, like, what could be changed given the economic constraints that are present, not just in New York City, everywhere with social services clients?
Well, I mean, within the foster care world, I mean, that's the eternal question. I think it's super complex and there's no easy answer. And I think there are people out there who are working in systems change who are well-intentioned and want to make appropriate changes for better outcomes for young people. I don't have any easy answers. I know that within foster care, something that happens often is this kind of what we kind of talked about earlier, which was kind of plucking young people out when things aren't going exactly as planned and replacing them in a new place and then another place. And there's kind of just litany of upheavals in their lives. And they never have an opportunity to connect with anyone. And when you have no opportunity to connect, you have no opportunity to trust. And I think that's where we're finding this huge issue with negative outcomes of youth coming in, out of foster care. I don't know the easy answer to that. I think part of it is, you know, a lot of the money stream is for beds, right, and filling those beds. So it's not really addressing needs of youth in particular and individually, but it's just this kind of like blanket response, fill the bed, to get your money as an agency from the city or state. So I think, and it's easy to say, and I'm sure not easy to do in any way, but to kind of look through a different lens and respond to the individual needs from a trauma-informed perspective for these young people. I think that's something that could make a huge change for a lot of people. And, you know, building from a trauma-informed perspective where there is that caring, consistent adult in their lives, that they can build a relationship. A lot of the young people I worked with had mentors that were outside of our program and who I know still are connected to those mentors and who consider them as family and sometimes as their parents. So, and those young people have been, you know, more successful, quote unquote, in moving forward in their lives. So I know that connection is a huge component, and I feel like the disconnection that the system currently kind of works with in that model needs to be reformed.
Earlier, you mentioned these like potential family meet and greet events where people who might want to adopt or at least foster kids will show up at a place where foster kids are. After a while, you found only a couple kids in the program that you worked in would even bother showing up because they knew they would be rejected.
Right. Yeah, it was heartbreaking to see. I mean, it's basically an auditorium filled with prospective adoptive or foster parents. And then youth are brought up on stage and telling their stories and exposing their wounds and basically vying for a position, making themselves look as appealing as possible to potential foster parents. It's a very uncomfortable position to be in as someone who cares, pardon me, who cares for these young people. You know, and the intention is great, but it's oftentimes, I think it's re-traumatizing for young people. And mm-hmm. I think it puts in perspective who folks think deserve support and assistance. You know, is their story tragic enough?
Huh.
For them to gain support. And I think that's a dangerous slope.
You note in the book that there are 2 million LGBT adults in America willing to foster or adopt. It would seem that some of these adults might potentially be ideal guardians for these teenagers. What's the impediment to placement?
The impediment to placement is foster care agencies don't want to work with LGBT folks oftentimes. Many foster care agencies are faith-based, and oftentimes don't want to work with LGBT folks, won't even accept applications from LGBT folks. So, yeah, there are numerous, like you stated, 2 million LGBT adults who are willing to foster or adopt in the United States, and 60% of the foster care agencies report never having placed a youth with LGBT couples or individuals, and 40% of the agencies said they would not accept applications.
Why would someone not do a pilot program to demonstrate that children will be okay with these families, with these adults?
I mean, probably around funding, but there are grassroots and outside the system approaches to that. There's something called a host home model, and that's kind of what I run right now in Minneapolis, where volunteers within the community open up their home to a young person in need and provide food and shelter for up to a year. So the expectation is around food and shelter, and we know that the relationship is a crucial component, but, you know, we let there be room for growth there. But this is a community-based response to LGBT homelessness, and it works quite well. There's about 75% success rate of youth who come into a host home program who end up having more secure housing once they leave.
Is there a movement within the LGBT adult community to sort of, these children are the entire society's responsibility, but does the LGBT community in particular feel like the issues that these kids have experienced are things that they can relate to? And to the extent that they would maybe go out on a limb to take in a teenager rather than an adorable infant?
As far as hosting or fostering, I don't know. I can say that there are great agencies doing great work around this issue. I think the True Colors Fund is doing wonderful work. There's Ali Forney in New York, and New Alternatives and Trinity Place. There's great agencies that are doing shelter work and doing kind of systems-based policy work around what needs to be done to address these issues. As far as individuals kind of stepping up, like I mentioned, there's the host home program, which really is a community-based response. So I'm saying the LGBT community in Minneapolis mm-hmm. identified that there was this need. And then the program is outside the system. So it was created in response, and it is sustained by the community. And I think there are pockets of that all over the country. They're small, and they're in response to what the need is, because there are, there's a scarcity of shelter beds for young people in need. They're incredibly expensive to build and to operate. And something like a volunteer program, like I mentioned, is a great alternative because it's self-sustaining and it's a volunteer-based program. That's a small response to a really large problem, but it's part of the response. I think if we take small responses and build on them and bring them together, it starts to grow.
Were you keeping a journal throughout the time that you were working in New York City?
I was. It was hard not to. Some amazing things were said when I was working. I didn't have the intention of writing about the youth when I was working with them. I felt like it just felt too exploitive.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really any intention to write about them. Once I left the position and went to grad school, I realized that these voices were silent and that there wasn't a conversation happening around which I feel is a crucial issue. And so that's kind of where the writing started from. So yeah, there are scraps of journals. When doing the work, you're constantly writing narrative. You're constantly writing stories. So and then you go and you have a meeting about those stories. And so it's really embedded, in you as you do this work. So this is not journalism. It's definitely memoir. It's nonfiction. But I had a lot of experience preparing for something like this just through the work that I was doing.
Do you write fiction as well?
I studied fiction as an undergrad, but I haven't written fiction for a while. I've been focused on this for quite a while.
I wonder if you ever struggled with, should this be memoir or should this, should I turn this into something like a novel or a series of essays or short stories?
Right. There was that question early on. And I think even when I was in grad school for creative writing, there was a question about from my peers if this should be because I think I use the tools of fiction within the mm-hmm. writing. But it was really imperative to me that people know that these stories are true and that these lives matter, and that, you know, the goal of this book really is to evoke change, is to build empathy. I think we operate from a place of empathy. We can read statistics all we want, and yeah, they may affect us to some extent, but I feel like people really are moved to make change through empathy, and that was the main goal of the book. So I thought it was very important that people realize that these stories were true.
How are you keeping up with the subjects in the book that you have, in fact, been able to maintain a relationship with? Is that all Facebook and Twitter and that sort of thing?
Mostly Facebook, and yeah, it's mostly through social media. I'm doing a reading tonight with a former youth that I worked with that's in the book. You know, a goal for me is I really hope that this book creates space for other narratives, for other voices, for the youth's voices to tell their own stories. And so something that I'm trying to do as I promote the book is to bring youth in. Maybe it's not in different cities, youth that I haven't worked with, but maybe have formerly experienced homelessness and have a need or want to share their experience. So I really feel like it's important that this is just not coming from me, but that there is space made available to young people to tell their own stories and give agency to them.
Were you taken aback in the beginning to learn how significant the percentage of homeless teens were also LGBT?
I had no idea coming into the work. Yeah. I had no idea. I mean, 40% of all homeless youth identify as LGBT but make up 8% of the population. I mean, that's astonishing. Something's wrong. Something's deeply, deeply wrong with that. So, I was really taken back by it. And I think that was one of the core issues when I was doing the work, realizing as we transition youth out of foster care that they're not going into permanency. That's the goal, right? Permanency, that they have some place to go, and that many of them didn't have a place to go, and that we're ushering them out of a system into the streets. And that just felt criminal to me. So that's why I work on the other side of it now, on the homeless youth side.
Ryan Berg is Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow and a one-time caseworker in a New York City group home for teenagers. His new book is called No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions. Ryan, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.